What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. A while back, a friend of the pod asked me what subscriptions I'd recommend for news and analysis on world politics. And it was actually a hard question to answer on the spot, believe it or not. But I've got a great answer now. Mother effin' World Politics Review. If you're a fan of Undiplomatic, you should be reading World Politics Review. It's obviously worldly. It's in the title. It's not obsessed with Trump, and it has a great mix of analysis and journalism. Also, why do you think I'm doing this pitch? World Politics Review is an official sponsor of the show, and the best way to back us right now is to back them. So give them a chance. They're offering a 25% discount subscription for Undiplomatic listeners, and if you want to subscribe to their daily newsletter, which you should, you can do it for free. Just visit wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That's wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That'll get you the free newsletter, and it'll also provide you the code for the 25% discount should you want to subscribe. So get on the train, wpr.pub/undiplomatic. Peace. What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. We've got distributed again, Pete McKenzie back, Kiara Mitchell, Gabby Magnuson, Jake Dello. This is the full house. This is the definition of full house.
Literally.
Yeah. So last episode, we spent like fucking like 40 minutes out of an hour before we even got to the segments. So we might need to go through quick hits quicker this week. And that's my, I'm to blame. Because somebody needed to discipline me.
You guys can be like, I leave the podcast for a few weeks and things just go to shit. Like,
yeah. Pete was the enforcer on time.
100%. That's clearly I'm the law abider in this group.
Yeah. Two quick hits to expedite things. One, if you haven't read it, journalist at The Atlantic, Uri Friedman, friend of the pod, did this profile about the PM for New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, and about how New Zealand's responding to the pandemic. We're looking down the possibility of maybe actually eradicating COVID-19. Or at least we're talking about eradicating it, whereas like most countries can't even fathom the possibility. And so it's early days. Like, I actually feel like it's not super prudent to declare mission accomplished quite yet, but we're looking better and we're on trend to be performing better than other countries, especially the United States. And so the Atlantic piece is trying to figure out what is the explanation for the New Zealand difference. I don't know, Kiwi exceptionalism or something. And it's just a great read. Also, it cites me a bunch of times. So like, this is indirectly a flex, but it's a great piece. So shout out. Did you guys read the piece?
For disclosure to our audience, the article's conclusion is literally just a multi-paragraph quote of that the author appears to have subcontracted out writing the article, which I thought was fantastic.
Oh yeah. I approve, obviously. And the unfortunately, if people read all the way to the end, like, it ends pretty grimly or pessimistically for such a glowing article. But yeah, that's my nature.
To be fair, I'm no fan of Labour or New Zealand politics in general, or Jacinda Ardern, really. But credit where credit's due, we've got this virus in a better place than anyone else has, pretty much.
It could be worse. So, like, I did a bunch of interviews after that piece this past 3 or 4 days, like people, media outlets contacting me because they saw the piece, which is pretty ridiculous and kind of in the loop. But in those interviews, I was sort of being compelled to say that like any New Zealand politicians would have performed similarly under the same circumstances. But I'm not sure if that's true because like the opposition leadership here sucks. Yeah. So obviously people on this podcast don't love the opposition in New Zealand politics. And for listeners, sorry, this is like inside baseball in New Zealand. Simon Bridges is the leader of the National Party, which is the Conservatives, which is the opposition. Obviously not the main demo of my show, but if you're listening, you're welcome to listen. One other quick hit. The American Interest, the magazine, published an anonymous piece from a Government of Japan official, which this is, I believe, literally unprecedented. I've never seen an anonymous piece from like a foreign government official, not least from an Asian country. And in the piece, this anonymous, the government of Japan right now is, it's a conservative-led coalition. So like on foreign policy, they're very pro-alliance and very hawkish for a country that is notionally pacifist. And the piece says that America's policy of maximum pressure toward North Korea, which is a big fat failure, the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, which is pretty like provocative and it's a failure on implementation, and then the elevated importance of Southeast Asia in U.S. strategy, which is rhetorical only and not substantive. All of these things were things that the Japanese fed to the Trump administration. And so they're taking credit for the things that appear to be most successful in Trump administration foreign policy, which is so weird. And it's like a pro-Trump piece in a way, but it's also kind of ringing alarm bells about, like, I don't know, fear of abandonment and underscoring this question of Trump's competence or like America's competence because of the excessive burden sharing demands. You know, Prime Minister Abe in Japan has like cultivated this friendship with Trump. He's gone out of his way to do it. They signed a new trade agreement that's very favorable to the U.S. And still, Japan got hit with the request for like quadrupling of burden sharing funds as payment for U.S. troops. And I just wanted to highlight this, one, because it's unprecedented. Two, last week we talked about how like in South Korean politics, the left in South Korea just won like big. So now if Trump wins the election, everything melts, everything explodes. But if Biden wins, which is like what people think is the good scenario, you're going to have South Korea be a leftist government and they control the National Assembly too. And then you're going to have this hawkish right-wing government in Japan, both allies of the U.S. They have 100% divergent views about what reassures, what deters. And so Japan will want us to send nuclear bombers and do preemptive strikes and like all this crazy shit. And they will feel better about themselves if we do it, the government, not society. And then the South Korean left, the last thing that will reassure them is a nuclear bomber. Like, they want the reassurance of pursuing a peace initiative with North Korea, of pursuing arms control, of like, you know, modernizing or drawing down the U.S. troop presence to some degree. Like, they want stabilizing measures. And so we're in trouble here. And I feel like nobody sees this, and so I'm mentioning it now.
I know we were going to have this segment short, but I have to ask, what side are you on in this fight, man?
You just start something?
That is hard to answer. I'm So when I was in the Obama administration, if you were an Asia hand, especially if you were like, you dealt with the allies, alliance management stuff, we were all hawks. We were all hawks, but like the people who were like had more progressively minded did not think of themselves as hawks. But like looking back, we had policy positions that were like fairly hawkish. And it's not that it was wrong, it's that it's like proven to have not worked, right? Like North Korea is a bad actor. It's just a question of like now their nuclear capability is such that we can't afford to take a hawkish posture, which means that there are strategic reasons to take the more dovish view, if to oversimplify things a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So there's room now to declare an end to the Korean War. There's room now to pursue arms control in lieu of denuclearization because it's too late to pursue denuclearization. There's room now to build ties to elites in North Korea, just in case, you know, we'll talk about this later in the show, Kim Jong-un kicks the fucking bucket and just like dies suddenly. We're fucked. We don't have relationships up there. So yeah, I want to do what reassures the allies, but that's not possible when your allies have completely contradictory views about what will reassure them. So I have not figured out what to do about this quite yet. It's a puzzle, a problem. Maybe I need to write about it. I don't know.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them.
All right, for Prediction Market this week, question one, will Kim Jong-un survive until August?
Wow, that's very direct.
In which way?
I love that it takes for granted the idea that he's already dying.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if you saw John DeLurie, who's a buddy of mine at Yonsei University. He tweeted that Twitter almost killed Kim Jong-un yesterday, like the other day. Pretty good take. Yeah, so this is not an easy question to answer. I'm going to say yes, only because I don't think the world can handle yet another big crisis. And if he kicks the bucket too soon, that will be a big crisis. So I'm going to say
yes.
It is
April. We're kind of overdue.
Who's next in succession order?
That's why there, yeah, great question. That's why there will be a crisis, because there is nobody lined up. He has a son, but he's way too young. A son / children, way too young, like 5 years old, I think.
Seven when I was trying to research, and I couldn't find anything.
Yeah. Also, we just don't have a lot of good facts. Like, we don't even know. Yeah. Technically, we don't know what his age is, although we figure he's the same age as me. And his sister, Kim Yo-jong, she's become more influential under his leadership. And she's been placed in some key positions in leadership committees. But she's not that powerful yet. And she is a woman in a very, like, patriarchal culture. And so there's no hereditary succession in a dictatorship is already pretty rare in the modern world. And North Korea has pulled it off two times now. And that to think that they could pull it off a third, it's possible, but, like, I mean, the odds are not great. And there really is no precedent for that kind of hereditary leadership to pass to a woman. So it seems pretty unlikely, but if it's not her, the only claim to legitimacy of rule in North Korea is the bloodline. And so this raises lots of questions about who would succeed if the military is the most influential, like, interest group, but how could they take over? How would they have legitimacy is a huge question. And that's why there would be a big crisis. There's a government in exile called Free Joseon Movement.
Yeah.
Super interesting, but, like, also highly volatile. And it's a variable in this that could end up causing huge problems. I mean, feeding, like, a civil war in a nuclear state kind of problems, depending on what happens. And all of this gets triggered if Kim Jong-un dies anytime soon, like in the next few years, which could happen because he's not in good shape health-wise.
Question: so will we see any further escalation from the United States following the direct Iranian threat to destroy United States ships if, air quotes, their security appears to be threatened?
Yeah, so if you haven't seen Trump's tweet about this, or, you know, coercive diplomacy by tweet, he threatened precisely what Jake just said, right? It's a powder keg. I think Iran is serious. I think Iran is serious about firing on U.S. ships if their ships are threatened. I think they have no choice but to be serious.
Yeah, like, they really don't.
They cannot afford to show weakness to somebody like, to people like the Trump administration, to these, like, fucking Uber hawks. And I'm not giving them advice because that leads us to World War III, but that is what I foresee happening. So I don't know how to answer this question because I only have bad thoughts.
Yeah, it's pretty tragic, and it just takes us back to the New Year period, doesn't it?
When we were on the brink of war and with Iran. Yeah,
and everyone's forgotten about it, but it hasn't gone away. And I think this is important for people to at least recognize. Like, the problem hasn't gone away. We've just moved on to something greater, i.e. coronavirus.
Yes. So, fucking sales pitch for security studies, man. Like, this is, if you study the causes of war, it tips you off to how the structure of relationships can incentivize sort of bad statecraft or bad decision-making. And so you can see indicators lighting up for war before war actually happens. And that doesn't mean war is inevitable, but if it happens, you shouldn't be surprised, because, like, you've been seeing these clues lighten up the whole time. And that's where we've been at with Iran for a long time. That's where that was, like, the premise of my North Korea book with the 2017 crisis. Like, you know, we have to pay attention to those things, and we have to turn off those indicators when they light up, and we haven't been. we've been like just wantonly accepting those risks. And so like war is always a low probability phenomenon, but war also is something that does happen despite being low probability. So like I'm worried.
Question three, keeping up with tradition of question three sucker punch question. Will we see any challenge to Canada's sovereignty over the Northwest Passage before November?
So I don't know where this question's coming from. Is there news that triggered this, or?
Well, essentially, it's sort of my thinking, right? Was that it ties in with the theme of allies of the United States distancing themselves, because in the past year, as well as multiple news this year, Canada's made efforts to essentially de-ice the Northwest Passage to provide a solo trading route to everywhere else on the planet that doesn't have to go through United States controlled spheres. And I think that's pretty huge. And the article, funnily enough, even though it's not the question, posed the question, what's going to happen now to the Bering Strait? Is that going to become another strategic area? So I was just wondering if you see the Northwest Passage as strategic as I do, and maybe even Canada does.
Yeah, it is strategic. Contested and new trade routes are going to be very strategically valuable. Just, I mean, like now and forever. I mean, I guess they've never not been valuable, but like, I think there'll be a premium on them in the future. And especially as the U.S. becomes like more and more volatile. What I didn't understand from the question is if you thought the U.S. was going to challenge Canada's sovereignty.
Well, anyone could be. Just anyone. The United States. Anyone really with the card to play, which unfortunately is most of the great powers.
I'll say no by November, but at some point I foresee Russia playing games, particularly if the oil market stays in the shitter, because I don't know if you saw, like, now oil's futures are trading negative, which is just mind-blowing. That's bad for Russia, and we don't know what the consequences of that will be for Russian foreign policy. We don't know what the consequences of economic downturns will be for the foreign policies of dictatorships in general. And there are different schools of thought, and the worrying school of thought is that it gives impetus for more expansive or assertive foreign policies. And this challenging Canada's sovereignty over trading routes would be in that category. So I'm going to say no, not by November.
Cool. So that looks like a no, maybe yes or no, and a no. Let's prediction market this week.
All right.
Time for Save Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
All right, stay off Twitter. Two short, juicy ones from me. One is from Jackie Schneider, who is at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. She used to be at Naval War College. And this is actually personal because it describes my fucking mindset. She said, "A friend told me at the beginning of this that I'm going to have to learn to write in 30-minute chunks. For fun, I started timing my uninterrupted writing time. What is the average time my kids leave me alone in any chunk of the day? 4.5 minutes, about the time to write one tweet." And this is my life. I guarantee I'm not going to get through this podcast today without my kid coming in here and interrupting like he did last week. And
calling us suckers again.
Yeah.
Come on.
He is so cute.
What a legend.
He is cute, but it's not cost-free, that cuteness.
I never took you for such a liberal, man. I never took you for such a liberal.
This whole situation, like, I'm not complaining as I say this. I'm not complaining. Because if you have a job and you have your health in this environment, that's pretty good. But it is hard as fuck to do homeschooling while you have to work yourself and while your spouse has to work too. Like balancing this is proving to be damn near impossible. My stress levels are like just through the roof. My brain 24 hours a day is Twitter brain, where like I can't cohere thoughts larger than like 280 characters. This is a problem, man. This is a problem, because this is what the most fortunate of us are experiencing, it seems like. And if you layer onto that a health problem or like a job loss problem. Fuck, how does this end, man? So shout out to Jackie because she tapped into my fucking, I don't know what you call this, rage. Like, I'm just done. I'm done, man. Second tweet from Aiden Smith. He just says, this is super short. Two things are true. The PRC is one of the most brutal regimes on the planet, and calling it the quote-unquote Chinese virus will literally only serve to incite stochastic terrorism against Asians and mobilize the public for a second Cold War. That's the tweet-level version of, like, the theme of this show, it seems like, for months. China bad, but race baiting about China also bad, to put it succinctly.
I know we shouldn't look for logic chains in Trumpian behavior, but it really is a matter of like one, race bait, two, ? three, People's Republic of China falls. Like, it's insane it's insane when you lay it out just that simply.
There's an ethno-nationalist driver in U.S. policy, and it rears its head, not all the time, but certainly more consistently than other potential drivers of U.S. policy, enough to be like a non-trivial factor. So I'm worried about that. I mean, the American people are pretty primed. I have relatives who are, they don't dial into politics at all, except to be like, you know, MAGA Trump conservatives, but like they don't pay attention to foreign policy, and they're ready for war with China. And that's based on like nothing really. It's based on fact or not fact. It's based on fucking propaganda, and it's based on attitude. Like, somebody needs to be responsible for this. The virus came from China. China has to pay. Right. And that sentiment is building, and it provides like, it animates sort of like mainstream policies that are going to be more aggressive on China in ways that are probably not going to like intersect well with China's own behavior. You can foresee a clash here. Dare I say a clash of civilizations not because clash of civilizations is real, but because the Trump administration is making it real. And that is very concerning to me. That was what the tweet sort of got at.
I reserve the right to die on the hill of impartiality on this one. Like, we don't have to pick a side when both sides are shit. Everyone's being ethno-nationalist and sort of neo-fascistic.
Yes. It's a plague on both your houses situation, but the character of how each guy's being a bad guy is like different, or the reasons are different on both sides to some extent. I don't want to be like a both sidesism person, but
neither. Do you see one as being more nefarious than the other?
I mean, right now, up until this point, China is the worst of the two evils for sure. In part because the U.S. is pluralist, even in its foreign policy. So, like, if you can engage with the better angels of America, if you just search out the right people, the right interest groups, you know, even within the government, there are some good guys, and the international system, for better or worse, increasingly for worse, still relies on the U.S. maybe more than it should, but still relies on the U.S. quite a bit. The U.S. could be much, much worse. I'm not sure how much worse China could be without just going to war or invading people, exporting authoritarian technologies, large-scale internment camps, propaganda, lying about a virus that has destroyed the modern economy as we know it, plus lots of lives. Yeah. Like, this is pretty fucking bad. Like, I don't want to compare track records, but like, China's worse.
That's sort of what I get from it. Like, China being worse, America being worse, and the fact that the leader is a blubbering idiot, but China being bad, and the fact that they have some real infernal machinations that if they had the chance, they would happily put out into the world.
Yeah, it worries me a lot. And the U.S. has a ways to fall. So, like, the U.S. could become a lot worse, and it would be a real bad day for the world. And so that's kind of what's at stake in the 2020 election.
So I'm both my tweets for this week are directly related to stuff we've already talked about. The first one, I'm basically a segue from Van's last tweet. I decided to bring it up because here at the pod, we love to stir shit and call people out. So this tweet is one from Gordon G. Chang, who says, as I write this, more than 45,100 Americans have succumbed to the coronavirus. China killed them. Why are we still doing business with that country? Your thoughts, Van?
Well, obviously, I agree. Just kidding. That's to be clear, I was being sarcastic.
What's not pictured is me hitting my head against my desk.
Yeah. So, Gort, for people who don't know, this is not a shout-out tweet. This is kind of like an FU tweet, or for staff Twitter segment anyway. Gordon Chang is a like right-wing Asia pundit, and there's not a ton of pundits who specialize in Asia who are uber hawks. Most of them are like pretty even keel, even the conservative ones. And Gordon Chang is famous for writing books about like the coming collapse of China. He's been saying China's going to collapse since the 90s, and he just keeps saying it. He writes about he's advocated pretty tough measures, including preventive strikes against North Korea. He's just like a hawk's hawk, and he peddles in basically memes. Like this tweet is kind of like a meme. It's at the level of like it's reducing reality so much that it's questionable how factual his statements are. And then he links an extreme policy position to these questionable statements of fact, right? So like more than 45,000 Americans have died. Yes. Because of coronavirus. Yes. Did China kill them? You're playing with facts and words at that point. And then to say that so that you can say the policy position of like, why are we still doing business with them? I do think that there are issues with like continuing to do business with neo-fascists, but you don't need to base that position on the fact that you're saying China like murdered all these Americans, because that is a declaration of war. And the weird thing about this is that there's a guy named Gordon Chang at Stanford University who is a history professor who specializes in Asia, specifically in China, and who's also a pundit, but he's a sane pundit, and so by comparison he's like left wing, or just relative, he's not partisan, but like relative to this Gordon Chang it's left wing. So it's very confusing, because the good Gordon Chang will write things that sound perfectly sane and reasonable about China, yeah, and about what we should do, and then the bad Gordon Chang will say this shit, and it happens all the time, and it's super confusing, and the only way you can tell them apart is by the extremeness of their divergent views. So like shout out to the good Gordon Chang who makes no appearance here, not shout out to the bad Gordon Chang who is trying to create a war with China.
You think you also have an evil twin out there, like another Van Jackson who's just completely opposite?
It might be the guy that owns vanjackson.com.
It might be. my old podcast, Pacific Pundit, the website Pacific Pundit was taken, and it was owned by like some alt-right group. And
yeah, I saw that.
Jesus.
And so like that's not great, but never with my name. So I don't know.
And I have to ask, going back to the very start of this tweet, is this what you think memes are?
A meme is you think of memes.
Just SpongeBob. What about SpongeBob? What does SpongeBob have to do with?
This is, again, the Gen Z versus everyone else distinction. A meme is just like a packet of simple information. It's like a piece of data. It conveys like one very simple thing. And so like an image does that very easily. But phrases do that too. This is a generational.
In his next TV hit, Ben's Chiron is just going to be meme connoisseur.
And it's going to be all tweets. And then the Gen Z's going to be like, these aren't memes, these are tweets.
This is just a book. It's like, no, it's a very big meme.
I've got lots of very big memes then.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
All right. So then going into my next tweet, this one is much more of an intelligent tweet thread. It's from Doyon Kim, who's a senior advisor of Northeast Asia New Policy for the Crisis Group, amongst other things. She hit out a couple of good tweets during the week, but one in particular caught my eye. In this tweet, Kim says, We should be very careful when hearing rumors and thinly sourced reports about Kim Jong-un's health and speculation about an imminent or looming death. We've been here with his father and grandfather and were wrong too many times before. It's easy to speculate. It was funny following the thread because literally as she was writing this out, South Korea was officially reporting that all the rumors were wrong.
Yeah.
And the rest of the thread is really good to read through, as well as the CNN interview she did. But I just wanted to highlight another one of her points while we're at it, which is that she says that, well, it's natural to wonder what if, like who the successor will be, what role his sister could play, potential day after plans, literally as we were doing in the prediction market. We really won't know until much later because there are too many variables about the future, which honestly, I think she's basically saying everything Van's already mentioned.
Yeah, no. So Do-Young Kim, I don't know if you guys ever saw the documentary I made. She features in it, like she appears in it. She's sort of a friend. And she, obviously like a pretty astute Korea watcher, everybody freaked out about the possibility of Kim Jong-un dying because it was plausible and high consequence. And it, like the fact that it was happening so soon made it even more high consequence, right? I thought people did, I didn't see a single expert, put it like, not quote unquote expert, but like expert, real person. Not a single one said claimed Kim Jong-un died or argued that he probably did. Everybody was like very responsible, I thought. But it was just like the most important topic in the world for like 5 minutes though, or for like a day. And so now there's like all these pieces out there about it, all of them urging us to take caution, and Do-Young's, her tweet thread is also like kind of urging us to take caution. And it's true that we just won't know until we know. But it's also true that this dude is, Bob Kelly had a counter tweet. We're all of agreement here, but he had a counter tweet that was like, there are lots of reasons to think that this could happen just around the corner. And it's so high consequence that we should all be paying attention to it and thinking through it. And like, I think that's valid also. We don't want to jump to any conclusions, particularly with North Korea. There's so few facts that we know of consequence, but we do need to think through, and you know, to some extent theory can be useful as a guide, but we need to think through what could happen and why and how we should respond. Because this is going to happen at some point, and I doubt there will be a successor lined up when it happens. He's just in such bad shape. It's not good. But shout out to Do-Young, yeah.
So it's worth clarifying that the only reason that people started to jump to the conclusion that Kim Jong-un must be dead was that he missed the anniversary of his grandfather's birth, or his grandfather's death.
His birthday,
or,
yeah.
Yeah, birthday. And
which
it's
is a
so
big
this,
deal.
This massive, a really massive event in the North Korean calendar.
Yeah.
It's pretty slim pickings to go on, but I'd be interested, Van, as to why you think he might have missed it, because it is quite a big deal. Well, what are the kind of options that aren't him dying?
More than likely, he missed it because he's not well, and he had a bad surgery. He had gone into surgery just before that. I think he had a bad surgery once before, and there's a litany of health problems that this guy has, for given his age, and and also, like, I think there probably is a certain amount of stress that comes with being, you know, a one-man dictator. Not that I'm, like, empathizing with him, but, you know, that could weigh on your health prospects, too. The weird thing about all of this is that somebody in the Trump administration leaked this to CNN, and that's where this came from. They claimed that Kim Jong-un was in grave danger, and it was an anonymous official. And what is that? Like, why would you do that? What is the point? And I said something like that on Twitter. It's like, why does the Trump administration or somebody in the Trump administration want everybody rumoring about this if it's not true? So that's the curious thing. And like, I actually don't have explanations for that. I don't understand it.
And for people who might not be fully engrossed in the North Korean situation, is the reason it was such a big deal for him to miss his grandfather's, being Kim Il-sung's commemoration, is because he's still the eternal head of state, right, in North Korea.
That's right. And the legitimacy, there's a longer story here, but the legitimacy of Kim regime rule ties to Kim Il-sung's rule, his grandfather. And so these commemorations and celebrations and these venerations of the bloodline and of the grandfather, these are the rituals that confirm and reaffirm your control of the country. Like if you fuck them off, you don't have legitimacy anymore. And so this is all symbolic, you know, pageantry or whatever, but it's the lock and key on control of the regime. And it's the only reason Kim Jong-un was in power, like the only reason. And so that it's existentially important for regime control that they keep the myth of the Kim family going. And so to miss that, to miss the birthday celebrations is to miss not just like a major national holiday, it's to miss going through the fucking rituals that concretize your rule, that make it possible for you to rule. So that's a big deal.
As a quick like side hit, if you follow Jean H. Lee, I know like Van probably does and everything. I usually keep looking at her stuff whenever stuff about North Korea pops up, especially with the health thing. I just remember like waking up and being like, no way Kim Jong-un's dead without, you know, seeing her tweet that. And she's got these amazing discussions already on her timeline, if you look at it, that it go through like all these explanations of like, hey, his health things. And so if you wanted more elaboration on that, you should definitely check it out.
Yeah, Jean Lee's a friend. She actually hosted my book launch at the Wilson Center last year.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it.
To take us away from North Korea and COVID-19, the two ongoing themes that we've been covering, I thought it'd be good to cover a piece that was in Foreign Affairs recently, which is The End of Grand Strategy by Dan Dresner, Ronald Krebs, and Randall Schweller. So three very different IR scholars. And the premise of the piece is that Trump's full frontal assault on the principle of liberal internationalism has prompted a re-examination of grand strategy. But that re-examination is moot because the era of grand strategy is over. The kind of grand strategy debate that scholars have been engaged in for decades works best on predictable terrain in a world where policymakers enjoy a clear understanding of the distribution of power, a solid domestic consensus about material goals and identity, national goals and identity, sorry, and stable political and national security institutions. And that in 2020, none of that exists anymore. And so they assert that because of emerging non-polarity, which has made the world much more entropic, and because of political polarization and populism destroying common institutions, common identity, and consistency, that policy can and should be made on a case-by-case basis, and that we should just give up the search for kind of a unifying grand theory or grand strategy, which is really interesting. And yeah, I was keen to get your thoughts, Van.
Yeah, this is it's a great piece, even though I don't like 100% sign on to it. There was a book a couple years ago. This is actually not a new argument, and maybe it's not possible to make new arguments anymore. I don't know. But Peter Dombrowski at the Naval War College in the U.S., he wrote a book called The End of Grand Strategy. So they lifted his fucking title, probably accidentally. But his argument was very similar, even though it was written like pre-Trump. And he was coming from a naval perspective. And he was like, look, there are certain maritime missions that the U.S. Navy is going to need to perform no matter what fucking naval gazing, excuse the pun, happens at the grand strategy level. No matter what big ideas Washington has, at the end of the day, the Navy needs to be able to keep open trade routes, prevent oil shipments from being shut down. They need to protect sea lines of communication. Like, there are missions that the military needs to perform regardless of what happens at the strategic level. That means we are in an era where grand strategic thinking doesn't change certain realities that you have to attend to on the ground. Kind of like a pragmatist argument of just focusing on the data in front of you or the cases in front of you. And that's kind of what they're arguing here. It's just not so naval focused. And I think there's value in saying, look, we need to be practical. I think there's value in being modest in our ambitions for the US especially. But the problem I have with this is that like the way it conceptualizes grand strategy is as this like blueprint basically of ambition. And that's one way of understanding grand strategy, but that's not really what grand strategy is. And you don't need to have a fixed certain world, which is kind of like the straw man that they put up, in order to have a good grand strategy or even to justify pursuing grand strategy. Like grand strategy is what you make of it. Or you could say it differently, like invoke Trotsky. You may not be interested in grand strategy. I knew you'd
love
that. My
boy.
I knew you'd love that. So like grand strategy, you may not be interested in it, but it's interested in you. And what happens is like when you play the small ball of saying we're not going to think strategically, we're just going to react to things as they come, you are operating a grand strategy. You just don't know what it is. You're not being transparent with yourself, conscientious.
Shooting yourself in the foot.
You're accepting intellectual and analytical blind spots, which is not for nothing. It's in the blind spots of decision making that black swans and wild cards exist. Black swans, like the fucking pandemic, like Kim Jong-un kicking a bucket all of a sudden, right? These low probability, high consequence things, to go back to the episode 2 weeks ago, that, I mean, they're game changers and they're foreseeable, but that you also can't predict them. And you can prepare for those things if you're thinking strategically, right? And so, like, I disagree with the bumper sticker of the piece, which is to, like, keep your gaze low or like don't try to see past the horizon. But I agree with the like building blocks of that bumper sticker of like needing to address cases on their merit. It's because a grand strategy, you will end up practicing a grand strategy no matter what. It's just a question of whether it's done with forethought or it emerges as a consequence of all the decisions you made, like a post hoc thing that you only see in hindsight. Not just because I teach grand strategy, but like there's value in strategic planning and strategic thinking. It helps you manage risk better. It helps you make decisions better. And you just have to, it's even more important when you're doing that in an environment that's high on uncertainty and polarization. Like all the things that they point to as reasons why we shouldn't have grand strategy are the things I would point to say, those are reasons why we need it more than ever.
Yeah, I really agree. And just to tease out something that you had in there, which is that grand strategy is not just a way of clarifying your own thoughts, but it's a way of clarifying your own weaknesses.
Yes.
And if you don't have a grand strategy, then you are deliberately allowing yourself to stumble around. You're deliberately ignoring the bits of your decision-making process, your heuristics, that are going to affect you in certain ways. And by having a grand strategy, it's not just about signaling an intention to the world, it's about signaling an intention to yourself, about taking those into consideration and really actively monitoring them when you're making decisions.
That's right. You want to be cognizant. You want to be aware of the bets that you're making, the wagers that you're making, and the risks that you're accepting when you make decisions. Who would not want to be aware of the implicit wagers in their decisions? Who would not want to be aware of the risks that are implicit in their decisions? I know Trump doesn't, but most, post-Enlightenment rational people would. You know, like our civilization is built on the presumption that we're going to prefer making efficient decisions, you know? So it's frustrating to me what they're encouraging here, but I also get where they're coming from. And if you look at, there are worse outcomes than trying to be pragmatic in every case. Like that's not a horrible thing. It's just that it means that you're going to accept blind spots, and that's not ideal.
You know, Van, I think that's such a good point. You need to prescribe that Trotsky reading to your next grand strategy class.
I'll package Trotsky as a meme and then present that. How about that? All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
But yeah, I hope you don't mind me asking for the first question this week. I was just wondering, were there any upcoming books, foreign policy or otherwise, that you're looking forward to read?
There's one book by a guy named Chris Bros, who's like, I think he's technically a Republican. He worked for John McCain. He's a defense guy. and he cites me in his book, which is like how somebody told me that he cited me anyway. I don't have the book, but it's about force structure and operational concepts of defense and how like basically the American way of war needs to change because of how technological trends are changing and how the international security environment is changing. I'm almost positive we don't agree 100%, but he has some sympathies for like the way left technocratic defense people, like specifically people like me, think about defense now, where it's like we sort of reject military superiority. We reject the idea of overmatch, like out killing your opponent as the way to win, and trying to think more creatively about strategy and deployments of force and use of force and like what investments you should make. And he's got a book about all that shit coming out imminently.
So the next question is from Nina Sawyer. Have you joined the Team Biden yet? Also, what do you eat in the average day?
So this is a super weird combination of questions.
Very Biden question, isn't it?
They're two unrelated questions. So have I joined Team Biden? I'll take them one at a time. So technically, I have not joined the team yet, but I sort of have. I don't even know how much I'm supposed to say. But my CV is in. They've sent me back some stuff that I need to like go through and sign. And presumably, I'll be restrained in certain things that I can say because of that stuff. I haven't gone through any of that yet, though, because I've just been too busy. I'm implicitly on the team, but I'm like in a gray zone right now. And also, it's not like it matters too much. His foreign policy direction is mostly set. And I'm probably not going in the administration. So, and then the second question was about my food.
What do you eat in the average day?
That's so
tell us what you eat.
We need to know.
But okay. So I drink a lot of coffee. I eat a lot of sourdough bread and feta cheese and eggs and fish. And then like fruit. And fruit in New Zealand is like pretty damn good. And that's like
maybe the bougiest answer I've ever heard.
Oh, avocado too.
Oh my God.
To add to the bougie.
What about halloumi? What about halloumi? Halloumi sounds like something that you'd be into, right?
I like the taste of halloumi. It doesn't sit well with me. So, like, feta is the only cheese I can eat that doesn't mess with my digestion.
Are you lactose intolerant? Oh, it's better than goat's cheese.
Oh, shit. Man, the indigestion podcast.
Somebody wanted to know, so there you go. There you go.
Top quality content. Thank you. Ask me anything.
Yeah.
Holy I'm pretty God. Sure also people could attest to your drinking coffee habits if they looked at when you post on Twitter. Like, what? Did you post this at 3 a.m? Okay.
Yeah. I'm up at them early.
So the next question is from Patrick Foran, a friend of the pod. The New York Times reported that the intelligence community thinks China has been lying about its virus, statistics, infection rates, etc. What do you think about it?
Well, I think China probably, I feel like it's common knowledge that China was lying about its reporting statistics on the virus. But I don't know what the real numbers are. It's interesting that the intelligence community would report or leak out to mainstream newspapers that they think China's lying. China is like kind of famous for juking stats, though. Like the stats on their economy, economists have claimed for like two decades that China's own productivity numbers, just having nothing to do with the virus, just the economy, are not accurate. And this is normal. I mean, think about like North Korea. Like that's normal in a dictatorship, right? Like you're not accountable, so you lie. And so that's what we should expect. I think they're also lying here, and I don't have like material in front of me, but is that not common knowledge? Is that a controversial take that China's lying about infection numbers?
No, I think it's pretty
I had to explain it to my younger sister.
Yeah. So China lied Trump lied. I mean, I don't. I guess that's the extent of the question. Yeah, I think that China's lying, but I don't know anything about what the true numbers are.
So, the last question is from a Washingtonian, also a friend of the pod. I'm an undergrad student at George Washington University. Would you recommend doing a master's degree at Victoria University of Wellington? And if I study with you, can I permanently move to New Zealand?
So I would definitely recommend doing a master's at Victoria University. And if you do it in IR or strategic studies, you would probably be doing it with me. Like, you definitely get, if you're an international student, you'll get a visa for as long as you're studying here for sure. And then I've seen some people enter the job market in New Zealand. So it happens that people come here for school and then stay. Like, I've heard there are case studies that I know of that being real. That's a thing. So if you came here to study, it's not impossible that you could stay. But I don't know how, and I don't know what the immigration rules are. And frankly, under fucking COVID-19, it seems like it's maybe would be harder, or maybe once you're here, it's actually harder to leave. I don't know. Like,
I'm sure this guy is a really lovely person, but like, stay the fuck away. We don't want anybody else.
Yeah.
We want jobs.
Yeah. I do know the degree carries. Like, I know people like Anna Fifield, the journalist at the Washington Post. She was the Beijing bureau chief before the pandemic. She's a Victoria University graduate. There's a bunch of people that are in the think tank space and scholars. So the degree has value, sort of, you know, transcendent value. And if you're intent on working in New Zealand, it does make sense to get the local degree, like to study here. But it's a small market. I mean, it's a small country to begin with. So like, they're not, you know, there's not a huge community of there's value. If you can figure out a way to use IR or use strategic studies yourself, there's a lot of potential. But like, I don't know, like the foreign service equivalent, or like foreign affairs here, I don't know how many applicants that they hire each year, but the number is probably not very large.
I will say, as someone who's just finished their master's at Vic, I did enjoy it a lot. And actually, as a side note, I don't know if Van knows this, but first semester, first week, first class doing his wargaming paper, because I was originally an IR student, I sat through your first class that Friday morning and was like, maybe I should switch. And that's when I went up to afterwards to be like, so what's the strategic studies master's like? And I ended up swapping over.
Oh, you were a master's in IR and you switched to strategic studies.
Yeah, basically. I took your first class. I was like, actually, this shit's pretty cool. And yeah. I ended up swapping over after having like a chat with you and with Manji. I think doing it, if you could, I think an option would even be if you're really that interested with studying with Van, which I recommend, and not just because I'm on his podcast. You could always think about doing exchanges, right? Like, you can always go to another country for like a short blip.
Anyway, it's a good place to study, good place to work, good place to live, but paradise is not for everybody. There are downsides. I'm sure Jake has complaints. Nope. Okay.
Like, all right, Jake.
He might have dropped off, actually. I don't know.
Yeah, I did. Something happened. Yeah, I do have some pretty massive complaints, but it's okay. It's okay.
Yeah.
For the sake of the pod, it's okay.
Oh, yeah, just real quick. If you want to submit Ask Me Anything question, where you just, you know, ask me anything, it's just askmeanything@undiplomaticpodcast.com. Send your question to that email address. We'll get it. askmeanything@undiplomaticpodcast.com. You can even find out what I'm eating, because why do you want to know that? All right, gang, that's going to do it. WPR.pub/undiplomatic for the sponsor's newsletter, World Politics Review. And buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic for COVID era money. All right. Peace.